KHT1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Oldsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Listen on the web at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio. Support for Trail Mix on KPR comes from Cromwell Environmental, serving Kansas and Missouri customers since 1982, offering testing and solutions for mold, lead, and asbestos problems. More information at CromwellEnvironmental.com. Right after this NPR News update, a song from the new album by Kate McDonald. And then we'll hear a classic Kelly Hunt song recorded live back in 2000. All ahead here on Kansas Public Radio.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. With just 2 days until Election Day, Republican Donald Trump is campaigning in the swing states of Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Georgia today. In Pennsylvania, at a rally in Lititz in the central part of the state, Trump repeatedly criticized the election process in the U.S.
You ought to damn well go to paper ballots. You ought to go to voter ID. And you ought to have the election over by 9 o'clock. I'm hearing now they're going to take weeks. Can you imagine? They spend all this money on machines, and they're going to say, we may take an extra 12 days to determine. And what do you think happens during that 12 days? What do you think happens?
Many states use paper ballots and require identification when voting. Vice President Harris's campaign has debuted a closing TV spot, a positive ad in which she pledges to be a president for all Americans. But the real message of the ad might be more in where and when it's airing. NPR's Eric McDaniel has more.
First, sports news. The Packers play the Lions on Sunday, an NFL matchup expected to draw millions and millions of viewers in Green Bay, in Detroit, and throughout the swing states of Wisconsin and Michigan. And the Harris campaign believes that putting this ad in front of Sunday NFL fans is a good way to reach Americans who are less than tuned in to the election. Here's Harris campaign chair Jen O'Malley Dillon in a call with reporters Saturday, speaking about undecided voters.
We still know there's some left, and we want to make sure we are the last people that voters are hearing from before they go vote.
The ad shows, in part, Harris speaking directly to viewers, asking for their support. Eric McDaniel, NPR News.
At least 6 people were injured and nearly 100,000 are without power following a damaging spate of tornadoes in central Oklahoma this morning. Robbie Korth from member station KOSU reports the tornadoes were part of a widespread storm system.
The National Weather Service issued more than a dozen tornado warnings overnight Saturday into early Sunday. The severe weather ripped through parts of Oklahoma City and leveled buildings nearby. Strong winds flipped vehicles and downed trees and power lines, leading to tens of thousands of outages. Further complicating recovery efforts was the sheer amount of rain, which led to flooding. Some communities received almost 5 inches from the storms. For NPR News, I'm Robbie Korth in Oklahoma City.
Moldova is holding a runoff presidential election today. The pro-Western incumbent Mayen Sandu is being challenged by a former prosecutor general who favors closer ties with Russia. She won 42% of the vote in the first round, not enough to win outright. Her national security adviser claimed today authorities are seeing massive interference by Russia in the election. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. Lawrence's own piano play and Kelly Hunt opens up this hour of Trail Mix on KPR.
Lost control. Sun dogs howl above my head. There's reason to go slow. I saw it all in slow motion. My heart beat like a drum. The good, the bad, and the ghost of things to come. There I was didn't know it, but I was standing at the gates. Torn up and tattered, grateful and electric too. Every breath felt like a miracle. Every heartbeat felt brand new. It was a big fat blessing. It was a beautiful surprise to be staring at the gates and reading with the earthly eyes. Staring at the gates of the east. The love of my life as my last breath slipped away. I could have turned to see that billboard, never seen another day. No matter what it looked like, I'd seen it every day. I've been staring at the gates of Eden. Coaster ride. It's champagne and potato chips, chocolate cherry pie. It's dancing with the devil to get your heart's desire. You know it might not look the way you thought it would, but
Kelly Hunt on KPR from her album a decade ago, The Beautiful Bones, that song, Gates of Eden. She wrote that along with Karen Miriam Goldberg and Al Berman, Gates of Eden from Kelly Hunt. And a big happening at the Lawrence Arts Center on November the 9th is a concert called Kelly Hunt Comes Home. It celebrates 30 years since her first album was released. Should be a real fun night at that, 7:30 p.m. at the Lawrence Arts Center on November the 9th. Now, late afternoon, before at 5 p.m., there's a songwriting workshop. That is free, but you have to register in advance. Info on both the workshop and the concert at the Lawrence Arts Center homepage, which is lawrenceartscenter.org. For Kelly Hunt, the big concert, November the 9th, Kelly Hunt Comes Home, the name of that show. Karen Zavoka up next in 15 minutes. We'll hear from a new album by Amanda Ann Platt and the Honeycutters on KPR. This one from 1995, the title track to Karen Zavoka and her band at the time called The Mind's Eye. The song On the River Road on KPR.
since she quit smoking. Got a nose like a bloodhound. If you want her when she's around. Sister Sheila, standing on the corner, dressed all in black, looking just like a mourner. Nobody told her, nobody warned her about the heartbreaking, what it did. Singing, honey, honey, I got to know you. Ain't got no money, but I got plenty to show you. Honey, honey, meet me on the river road. Chi-Chi Raposo got a head like a bean, but he spears a T-bird like you never see. Picks up the young ones at the Dairy Queen, saying, hop on.
Savoca and the Mind's Eye, the title track, the 1995 album On the River Road, the Mind's Eye, Karen Savoca with the guitarist Pete Heisman, bassist Tom T-Bone Woke, here on KPR's Trail Mix. They're out of Syracuse, New York, and boy, Karen and Pete did a fantastic opening set for a memorable Greg Brown show here in Lawrence, probably close to 30 years ago, maybe a little less than that. Karen Savoca on KPR. In a few minutes, we're going to hear the only Halloween breakup song I know of, or maybe Halloween I just got dumped song is a better description of that. So we'll be doing that shortly. We've got Amanda Ann Platt and the Honeycutters from a new album up next here on KPR's Trail Mix.
Are you old? Are you new? Are you borrowed? Are you blue? Are you something I could hold on to? Or just one more thing that I'd be scared to lose? It's a circle, so they say, all our years and all our days. What a puzzle, what a maze, holds us tightly then. Mama's name. We never knew where the days went, and what we never know, we never can forget. By the light of the morning, empty bottles tell no lies, but the muse of time waits for you, and she's bringing. such a pretty thing. Wearing a boardwalk ring. It's such a windy world out there. And everybody keeps on blowing away. I try to tell myself that I don't care. But I learn to love the ones that stay.
Honeycutters, two songs there, The Muse of Time and Mirage. From their new album, came out in August, called The Ones That Stay, the North Carolina-based, Asheville, North Carolina-based band, Amanda Ann Platt, and hope that they got through the storm okay. Know a lot of musicians in that area, and a lot of them lost a lot of possessions, but I think they all came through it healthy, all the ones I know, and that is good. Amanda Ann Platt and the Honeycutters, I think a band that is not getting enough recognition as they should. So I tried to give them some there. Hope you like them. Richard Schindel is up next. Jamie Harris on the way in just a bit. Support for Trail Mix on KPR comes from KU Theater, presenting Hook Man, a darkly comic salute to teenage slasher films, reminding everyone that college can be scary. Playing Friday through Thursday, November the 7th. Tickets at KUtheater.com. Well, here is, as I mentioned, my song for Halloween this year. I decided to stay away from the usual blend of witches and devils and the like and come up with kind of a Halloween song grounded in real life, although the song was made up. And it's a Halloween breakup song or a Halloween I got dumped song, maybe. It's Richard Schindel and his song, Are You Happy Now? Here on KPR.
The toaster when you went, you never paid your half the rent. You took the spices from the rack, but you don't have to put them back. Cause in your haste on Halloween, you left your camera on the bed where we played roles in black and white. You left a roll of black and white. I set the timer and thought of you. Put the lens up to my head. I took a photograph for you. What comes out gray is really red. So are you happy now? Are you happy now? Well, are you happy now? Smashed your pumpkin on the floor. The candle flickered at my feet as goblins flew across the moon. The children peered into the room. A cowboy shivered on the porch. Soon Cinderella checked her watch. A hobo waited in the street. An angel whispered, trick or treat. But what was I supposed to do but to sit there in the dark? I was amazed to think that you could take the candy with you too. Are you happy now? Are you happy now? Out all night, and now it's dawn, and I cannot believe my eyes. There's garbage strewn across the lawn, where we once stared up at the sky. Streams of paper fill the tree that hovered over you and me. And shaving cream covers the car that we picked up in Baltimore. Though I know it's hard to tell, I hope that what's-his-name treats you well. I still maintain that he's a bum, but it's your money, have some fun. Are you happy now? Are you happy now? You always asked why I had not written you a verse or two.
I seek you not to ask of you. It was in Kingston Town, indeed. It is said they stopped, but not for greed, but for the love of Spanish Mary. I remember well, they came one day, the buffoon, the fool, the fairy. They asked of me, what could I say, for the love of Spanish Mary. 'Tis not of me to talk absurd,
of a woman are hidden within. As she moves from one to the next, her spirit grows thin. And when she falls in love, it's hard, but it's true. But it's, oh, so much harder when that man is you.
Lost on the River, that was Rhiannon Giddens' musical setting for the lyrics of Bob Dylan. Lost on the River, another set of lyrics by Bob Dylan. Spanish Mary sung by Rhiannon Giddens on that Lost on the River song. Rhiannon wrote that together, the music together with Marcus Mumford. The Black Lily's on the way, and new music from the band Twisted Pine is up next. When you think of the most dangerous abolitionist in Kansas history, you may well think of John Brown. Well, next time on KPR Presents, the most dangerous abolitionist you probably haven't heard of before, as Todd Melfeld and David Schaefer join Kay McIntyre for KPR Presents, 6 o'clock this evening on Kansas Public Radio.
My cup was empty, I was feeling kind of homesick. Trying to hold it together, trying to get on with it. You know that feeling when the money gets tight. At a truck stop summer and you hope to make it through the night. But it's alright. Cause by the next morning you get up and go out in the street. About the best joints on the scene. Mama J's got the cake with the best dang buttercream. Man, it's a dream. Yeah, funky people know just what you need. Yeah.
eclectic and I think very cool Boston string band called Twisted Pine. That song called Funky People. The brand new album is called Love Your Mind from Twisted Pine. We're going to hear the great bluegrass and old-time music veteran Jody Stecker from a new album he's done with the band Mile 12. And up next, we've got music from just over a decade ago by the band The Black Lilies. Support for Trail Mix on KPR comes from the University of Kansas Libraries, a state, regional, and federal depository, providing the resources and partnerships necessary for both research and academic success. More info at lib.ku.edu. Here's the Black Lilies, their 2013 album, Runaway Freeway Blues, and we're going to hear two songs, beginning with Ramblin' Boy. This is not the Tom Paxton song. Rather, these are lyrics by A.P. Carter, sent to music by the lead vocalist and guitarist Cruz Contreras. Ramblin' Boy followed up by one written by Cruz called Goodbye Charlie. The Black Lilies on KPR. Myself 10,000 there.
18 years in the Tennessee sun, grew up fishing on the Cumberland. Little Joe, the youngest son, slung a slingshot and a squirrel gun. Slung a slingshot and a squirrel gun. Daddy ran shine neath the moonlight, bowling green to the Nashville nights. Little Joe learned to ride and shotgun, and keep your mouth shut till the job is done. And keep your mouth shut until the job is done. 67 rolled around, Joe got the call and he headed on out. Cross the ocean for the Vietnam. Gonna hit the coast running, gonna be gone. Jackie D meet Mary J, gonna do just what I say. Grab your gun and roll on out. Your first ramble gonna scream and shout. Your first ramble gonna scream and shout. Tie a ribbon around the old oak tree and tell my mama don't worry about me. Weather's warm around Christmas time. I've got an M16 and my boots are grimy. Sitting up here like a cat in a tree, and waiting for Charlie, gonna set him free. Uncle Sam said, I'm the man. Goodbye, Charlie. On the ground, snakes in the trees. There comes a gun and he don't know about me. Johnny's in the front, Charlie's in the back. There comes a crash in 6 days in the back. 6 days in the back. 6 days in the back. Sam said, son, thank you. Lay down your guns, cause we're through with you. Lay it down your guns, cause we're through with you. I see the ribbon around the old oak tree. I told my mama, don't worry about me. Weather is warm around Christmas time. I got an M16 and my boots are dry. Sitting up here like a cat in a tree, waiting for Charlie, gonna set him free. Uncle Sam said, I'm a man. Goodbye, Charlie. Uncle Sam said, I'm the man. Goodbye, Charlie.
The Black Lilies here on KPR from their 2013 album, Runaway Freeway Blues. We started off with the lyrics of A.P. Carter, set to music by the singer there, Cruz Contreras, and a song written by Cruz called Goodbye Charlie. The Black Lilies went their separate ways in 2018, I believe, but left behind some nice music, and we just heard some of that here on KPR with the new one from the veteran Jody Stecker up next. Support for Trail Mix on KPR comes from the Lead Center, presenting an a cappella group, Straight No Chaser, in their Top Shelf Tour Wednesday, November the 13th, 7:30 p.m. Tickets are available at lead.ku.edu. Well, there's a new album out featuring Jody Stecker, and he is one of the terrific musicians rooted in bluegrass and old-time music. And here he's heard with one of the fine young bands in bluegrass, Mile 12. The album together is called Instant Lonesome and the Twinkle Brigade. And the last number is a little bit different than either the bluegrass or the pure old-time music. It's a little ragtime guitar piece that Jody Stecker wrote. He calls it 50-50 Rag. Here's Jody Stecker with the band Mile 12 on Kansas Public Radio. Jody Stecker, the guitarist piece 50-50 Rag, from the new album by Jody here on KPR, joined by the bluegrass band Mile 12 for an album with the great title, Instant Lonesome and the Twinkle Brigade. Jody Stecker on KPR. Our support for Trail Mix comes from the Lead Center, presenting the acapella group Straight No Chaser in their Top Shelf Tour, Wednesday, November 13th, 7:30 p.m. Tickets available at lead.ku.edu.
Stardate November 3rd. Star clusters line up in the evening sky at this time of year like pearls on a necklace. As the sky gets nice and dark, they climb straight up the northeastern sky. They stretch from the bright star Capella, which is quite low, up through the W of Cassiopeia, then to Cygnus, the tail of the swan, high overhead. There's a good line of clusters because that path outlines the Milky Way, the subtle glow of the disk of our home galaxy. Most of the clusters are classified as open. All of the stars in such a cluster were born together from a giant cloud of gas and dust. But as the clusters orbit the center of the Milky Way, they're slowly pulled apart. So over time, all the stars in such a cluster go their own way. Perhaps the highlight of this path is the double cluster, two clusters in Perseus, just below Cassiopeia. Under dark skies, they're visible to the unaided eye as a faint cloud of light. Individually, the clusters are known as NGC 869 and 884. They're about 7,500 light-years away. Combined, their stars and gas add up to about 20,000 times the mass of the Sun. And they're quite young as stars go, about 14 million years. At that tender age, the clusters haven't had time to fall apart, and with their great mass, they're likely to hold together longer than most clusters, perhaps several hundred million years. Tomorrow, the crescent moon and the evening star. For the University of Texas at Austin McDonald Observatory, I'm Billy Henry.
And for Kansas Public Radio, I'm Bob McWilliams. Did you know that listeners are more apt to frequent businesses that support their local public radio station? If you run a business, you can harness that passion for public radio by becoming a KPR sponsor. Learn more at sponsorship.kansaspublicradio.org.
Next time on KPR Presents, the story of the most dangerous Kansas abolitionist you probably have never heard of, James Montgomery.
Montgomery was portrayed as this very kind of sinister, villainous sort of character, kind of slightly unhinged.
I'm Kay McIntyre. Join me and historians Todd Melfeld and David Schaefer on KPR Presents, 1 o'clock Sunday afternoon on KPR 2, 6 o'clock Sunday evening on KPR 1.
We're here and we are Kansas Public Radio. From the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Oldsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Listen on the web at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio. NPR news headlines and all things considered just ahead here on KPR, where support for Trail Mix comes from the Topeka Zoo, presenting zoo lights and the chance to host a private party or special event in a secluded igloo at the zoo. Details and reservations at topekazoo.org. I'm Bob McWilliams. I so appreciate you joining me this afternoon for Trail Mix. I'll be back with Jazz in the Night Wednesday night, Tuesday night on KPR. We'll have election coverage from National Public Radio and the KPR News team.
Kamala Harris benefited from an influx of people now saying that they are definitely going to vote.
Does a surprising result from one of the country's top pollsters show Vice President Kamala Harris on the rise? For Sunday, November 3rd, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Ahead, we will hear closing arguments from Harris and former President Donald Trump.
We're fighting like a son of a gun. We're fighting. They are fighting so hard to steal this damn thing.
And we will talk to a high-profile Pennsylvania Republican who is trying to counter Trump's false claims about election security. We will also pause for politics to talk
birds.
It took me a few days to figure it out and memorize its call, and now I perfected it.
First, this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. At a Pennsylvania rally today, Donald Trump promoted the baseless idea that election cheating and fraud are widespread. With 2 days to Election Day, it raises the question of how he and his supporters might react if he loses. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben has more.
As he has at other rallies, Trump continued to sow doubt about Pennsylvania's voting system.
There's only one reason you don't want voter ID. There's only one reason, and that's to cheat. There is no other reason. There's no other reason. And they do cheat.
Again, there is no evidence of this. Opponents of voter ID laws argue that they cause voter suppression, particularly in marginalized communities. Trump also suggested that he didn't have to leave the presidency after losing in 2020. Speaking of a rise in border crossings under Biden, Trump said, quote, I shouldn't have left. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News, Lititz, Pennsylvania.
And Vice President Harris campaigned in Michigan at several locations today, focusing on black and young voters. After a speech at a church in Detroit, Harris addressed Trump's comments on election fraud.
I think that it is a tactic. It is meant to distract from the fact that we have and support free and fair elections in our country. We did in 2020. He lost.
Tomorrow, Harris holds rallies in Pennsylvania, including Allentown, where more than half the population is Latino. Trump also has stops in the state, as well as rallies in North Carolina and Michigan. In Gaza City, several Palestinians, including children, have reportedly been wounded near a clinic that was giving polio vaccinations. NPR's Scott Newman has more from Tel Aviv.
The World Health Organization says the attack took place near the Sheikh Radwan Primary Health Center in northern Gaza, in an area where Israel and Hamas had earlier agreed to a humanitarian pause in the fighting. The UN organization says the strike happened as parents were bringing their children for polio vaccinations. The organization expressed concern that such attacks could deter future vaccination campaigns. The Israeli military says an initial review indicates it was not conducting operations in the area at the time. The attack comes in a weekend that UNICEF says was an especially deadly one for northern Gaza, with more than 50 children killed there. Scott Newman, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
And the Israeli military says it carried out a ground raid into Syria, detaining what they say is a Syrian citizen who's an Iranian operative in that country. It's the first time in this war that Israel has announced a troop operation in Syrian territory. Israel says the seizure is part of a special operation that took place in recent months without saying when it happened. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The fastest runners have finished what is billed as the world's biggest marathon. NPR's Amy Held reports the male and female winners each pulled away in the final steps for a close finish in New York City.
Somali Dutch runner Abde Nagayi won with a time of 2 hours 7 minutes 39 seconds, arms raised as he broke the tape in Central Park. And on the women's side, Sheila Chepkarui of Kenya came first at 2 hours 24 minutes 35 seconds,
she does come through,
powering past defending champion Helen Obiri. But for those who are not elite competitors and who finish several hours later, simply making it there can feel like a win. Just 4% of the 165,000 hopefuls who applied to a general lottery in March were chosen. The race began in 1970 with just a few dozen runners. Today, it surged past 50,000, drawing hundreds of thousands of spectators citywide and millions more watching around the world. Amy Held, NPR News.
At the weekend box office, Venom, The Last Dance, once again took the top spot with an estimated $26 million in ticket sales. The Sony and Marvel collaboration, starring Tom Hardy, has made more than $300 million globally. In second place, The Wild Robot with $7 million in its sixth week. The animated Charmers made over $121 million in North America and $269 million worldwide. Third place went to the horror film Smile 2 with $6 million. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Kauffman Foundation,
providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.
Here's a look at the KPR weather forecast. A flood watch has been issued for parts of our listening area. It's 67 and cloudy. Wind is from the south-southeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, thunderstorms with a low in the upper 50s. Wind will be from the south at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Then tomorrow, a few showers with a high in the upper 60s. Tomorrow night, a few showers with a low in the mid-40s. It's 67 and cloudy. That's KPR weather.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. In just a matter of days, we will know whether Vice President Kamala Harris or former President Donald Trump will be the 47th President of the United States. Until the polls closed Tuesday night, though, the best guess we've had has been public opinion polling. And this weekend gave us a final snapshot with, among other surveys, one of the most high-profile polls in the country issuing its findings. The Iowa poll, published by the Des Moines Register and conducted by J.N. Selzer's firm, Selzer & Company, found something rather surprising. Kamala Harris leading Donald Trump in Iowa, of all places, a state that has drifted further and further to the right in recent elections. Now, this matters because when the polling industry largely missed the mark in the past two presidential races, Selzer did not. When we spoke, Selzer said one explanation for Harris's gains could be the number of voters she polled who say they will definitely vote, a total that increased among women, young people, and those with college degrees.
Those are demographics that favor Democrats. Mm-hmm. And so Kamala Harris was the beneficiary of that. It wasn't that Donald Trump lost ground in terms of the raw number of respondents who were supporting him. It's just that Kamala Harris benefited from an influx of people now saying that they are definitely going to vote.
There's been such a focus on the gender gap, especially the way that the Harris and Trump campaign have really been appealing their messages, particularly to women or particularly to men in Trump's case. What was the gender gap that you saw with these results in Iowa?
Yeah. And we've been told by people who work with candidates all the time that if you're working the gender gap, you want to win more with one sex than you lose to the other. And Harris is doing exactly that. So 52-38, Trump leads among men. 56-36, a 20-point gap. Harris is leading with women, likely voters in Iowa.
And there's a story about older voters, older women in particular, right?
It's more than a 2-to-1 ratio of Harris to Trump, 63-28. Among women the age 65 and over. Now, Harris leads with men age 65 and over, but it's just a 2-point gap.
Hmm. I asked about one of the big questions of this election, which is the gender gap. Another big question, especially the way that the Harris campaign has focused its message in recent weeks, is whether Harris is able to successfully convince some Republicans to cross the aisle. Did you see signs of that?
Not much.
Yeah.
Not much. I can tell you that less than 1% of Democrats were crossing over to vote for Trump. There's a small single-digit percentage of Republicans crossing over to vote for Harris.
Mm-hmm. So much has been made broadly of how hard it is to find the right mix of voters right now. Mm-hmm. What is the broad explanation of how you are approaching determining what the electorate is going to look like?
Well, I do it the same way I've been doing it. I've made no change in that, to be clear. And this is going to get a little wonky. What I want to do is to collect data that will reveal to me what the future electorate is going to look like. I call it polling forward. I call people who are weighting their data looking at past elections polling backward.
Mm-hmm. This is now the third presidential cycle in a row where your final poll looks very different than the conventional wisdom and what most other polls are showing. The last two times, of course, you showed that Trump was doing much better than most observers thought, and you nailed that final Iowa result near perfectly. I'm curious what you're thinking when you see that initial wave of data and think, wow, this is going to be an outlier.
Well, you know, when I was younger and this would happen, there would be a certain amount of anxiety and stress and stomach churning events. I've been called the outlier queen. So I've sat in this chair before and, you know, I have a little talk with myself and I said, look, either my numbers will be good, in which case I'll be golden, or my numbers will be bad, in which case I'll be a skunk. And I'm prepared to deal with it either way.
So even on a day like this where you have Trump himself kind of attacking you in the polls, you're not fazed by it?
I'm not fazed by it.
That is pollster J. Ann Selzer. Thank you so much for talking to us.
My pleasure.
Once again, Pennsylvania is the biggest battleground state in this year's presidential election. And once again, misinformation and outright disinformation about Pennsylvania elections is circulating.
Over the past 24 hours, we've seen several videos shared widely online that lack proper context or were inaccurate, leading to false narratives.
That's Pennsylvania Secretary of State Al Schmidt, a Republican, in a video message decrying what he called bad faith actors who, quote, exploit fears about our elections and manufacture outrage. Though he did not mention anyone by name, hours earlier, former President Trump had posted a message online that began with, Pennsylvania is cheating. Now, 4 years ago, Trump lost Pennsylvania and other key states to Joe Biden and responded by casting doubt about the outcome and trying to overturn the result. Trump is signaling he may try similar tactics this year, which is where people like Pennsylvania's former governor, Tom Corbett, come in. Corbett is now with a group called Keep Our Republic.
It is an effort to demystify what I think a lot of people didn't understand, never knew, never bothered to know because it wasn't necessary, except for what happened in 2021.
That would be January 6th, 2021, the culmination of Trump's attempts to overturn the election results. Corbett is a Republican, though Keep Our Republic is a bipartisan group with a goal of educating the public about the elections process from when the polls close until the certification by Congress of electoral votes on January 6, 2025. Earlier this week, I asked Corbett if education was really the issue. There have been people like you pointing out how clear the court record was, how clear the evidence was, and yet there has been a real persistence in Republican voters especially in saying, no, the election was rigged, no, the election was stolen. Do you think it's an education issue?
Well, I think it's an education issue to maybe undecideds that are out there or people who haven't made up their mind or who are not part of one group or another. It's also an education issue to the media. And I think it's been very successful. I've seen a lot of reporting covering this now in the last 6 months. Obviously, that's because we're closer to the election as we speak here today. And it's necessary to continue to try and have a voice out there in my mind that explains the process to people. You're not going to overcome somebody standing on the bandbox and screaming this or that one way or the other. But having a group of individuals who have served in positions such as myself or U.S. attorneys or federal judges out there as a counterbalance to that, I think, is extremely important.
Are you planning on running for office again at any point?
No, I'm not planning on running for office.
The reason I ask that is I'm wondering, do you think a Republican with a goal of running again could be making the argument that you're making right now, given the dynamics?
Well, the dynamics in politics are always changing, as you well know. And frankly, I think President Trump's dynamic is one that if he is unsuccessful, may pass from the present day politic, may not, I don't know. But I have no intention of running because I'm 75 years old, and I think that's old enough to be in any office, and we should be moving on. We have a lot of young people out there that could do the job just as well or better.
I want to talk about what happens over the next week or so and what happens from Election Day on in a minute. But first, I just want to ask one more question about the way that the false narratives about last election have kind of dug into place. Have you had a face-to-face conversation doing this project where you've changed somebody's mind? And if so, what was the most effective argument?
Well, yes. I mean, friends of mine who believe that it's all rigged and everything, I think I've changed their mind in that because I've used my background as a prosecutor. And I said, you know, you can allege anything you want, but you have to be able to prove it. And 4 years into this, there hasn't been any evidence that anything was rigged, that anything was done to create a different outcome. I'll oftentimes say, has there been cheating in politics in the past? Sure, but not to the magnitude that somebody is saying that the entire election is rigged. And I think my statement of that, my reputation, convinces people to at least believe that statement. Mm-hmm. Even though some other people say, well, they're going to hack into the internet. Well, they can't, at least not in Pennsylvania. And I'm pretty sure that's the same in the other 49 states in the territory of Puerto Rico.
What are your biggest concerns? What are your biggest worries about next Tuesday onward in Pennsylvania specifically when it comes to the vote tallying, when it comes to the results, when it comes to how those results are framed?
I think I'm worried about violence on the outside, whether that might be foreign influence. I'm worried about people trying to intimidate, maybe intimidate people when they're in line at a polling place or to intimidate the election officials. I'm worried about the lack of civility that we see. I'm an optimistic at heart. I think the vast majority of the polling places were going to be fine. I worry about some of the polling places that may have a reputation of being a little tougher to go to or to present yourself to. Mm-hmm. And you have to worry that somebody's going to again continue to say, well, everything's rigged and, the vote has already been determined. It hasn't been. I think one of the positives now, though, is early voting. A lot of people have already voted. I'm very confident that between that process and the new equipment that they have, the Election Count Reform Act and the money that was supplied between the federal government and the state to the local election officials to continue to have overnight counting of the ballots are going to be very helpful in the long run.
I do want to ask, as you talk about how people view elections, how people think elections are fair or not, the potential of violence at the polls, all of these things, do you think all of this is a Donald Trump problem or do you think it's a broader problem?
I think it's a broader problem.
Yeah.
I think President Trump has brought it to everybody's attention with some of his presentations and allegations. We have a problem with where we're looking for our information because of the internet, because of the cell phones, and we are divided as a country between red team and blue team with people in between. And we're not being open enough to listen to what the other team has to say.
That's Tom Corbett, the former Republican governor of Pennsylvania. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. Available online anytime for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for All Things Considered here on a Sunday afternoon. Support for All Things Considered comes from Topeka's Nodo Arts and Entertainment District, featuring a celebration of souls, Day of the Dead in southern Mexico. Exploring the Dia de los Muertos holiday traditions and origins, now till December 14th. Information at explorenoto.org. And the Dole Institute of Politics, hosting former Congressman Luke Messer and Sherry Bustos for their series Congress in the 21st Century, Wednesday, November 13th, 4 p.m. More at doleinstitute.org. Tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, 30% chance of showers, cloudy with a low of 60 degrees, a 100% chance of showers for Monday. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. With just days to go to the election, both presidential candidates are on the campaign trail today, trying to win over undecided voters. Former President Trump has been campaigning in swing states Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Georgia, and Vice President Harris is spending the day in the swing state of Michigan. In Oklahoma, several people were injured, some hospitalized after severe storms and tornadoes struck the state early this morning. Dozens of buildings were damaged or destroyed, and thousands of customers are without power. And in Serbia, activists gathered to protest an accident at a train station. A roof collapsed, killing at least 14 people. The protesters are blaming the country's government, saying it was negligence and corruption. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. In today's political climate, conspiracy theories are commonplace, but they're nothing new. In fact, back in the 1960s, there was one organization that built a movement around them. The John Birch Society was started by a small group of wealthy businessmen, including Robert Welch and Fred Koch. It expanded with chapters of like-minded Americans meeting in private living rooms and finished basements across the country, fueled by conspiracy theories that caused a schism in presidential politics. While the John Birch Society's influence has waned, its impact is still felt today. Radio Diaries brings us that story.
Okay, here it goes.
Over hill, over dale, we will hit the commies' trail as we Birchers go marching along.
My name is Catherine Siegel. I'm here with my sister, Charlotte Meehan.
Our father was James Edward Meehan, an electrical engineer and a leader in the John Birch Society. We lived in Bridgeport, Connecticut, in a Spanish-style stucco house, and people would pile on down into the basement, and the meetings would happen there.
We will now open our meeting with a pledge of allegiance to the flag. I pledge allegiance.
They would start with the pledge, and then they would go through the John Birch bulletin.
Number two on our permanent agenda, and that is the United Nations, get us out. The United Nations was conceived by communists and is being used to further communist objectives.
Our parents were Jim and Olive, and they had five children, and it was in the 60s, right, at a time when there were a lot of, like, funky things going on in society, and it completely freaked them out.
When I was a coordinator for the Birch Society, my job was to go out and promote the formation of chapters and recruit some people. My name is Ed Griffin. I'm an author. If you look me up in Wikipedia, it starts off, G. Edward Griffin, well-known conspiracy theorist. They want to communicate to all the readers that this is a guy you don't want to listen to. I stumbled across the John Birch Society way back in 1960. I was 29 years old. I came across a booklet that they were distributing, The Deception of the United Nations, or something like that. And I thought, what? United Nations was our last best hope for peace. I got some books on the United Nations and so forth, and I suddenly realized, oh my gosh, this booklet is right.
Today, the truth I am bringing you is simple, incontrovertible, and deadly.
My name is Matthew Dalek. My book is Birchers, How the John Birch Society Radicalized the American Right. The founder, Robert Welch, conveyed a deep sense of grievance and anger. You're losing your country to traitors. And they're not just any traitors. They're actually traitors within.
We have only a few more years before the country in which we live will become four separate provinces in a worldwide communist dominion ruled by police state methods from the Kremlin.
The Birch Society was best known for its conspiracy theories. For example, the civil rights movement was a plot directed by the Kremlin.
We were taught that Martin Luther King was a red and a communist.
Our father had a kind of paranoia. He had this feeling that there are a lot of enemies out there.
The other person that was demonized in our household was Mr. Rogers, because he was a red.
Oh, there's Officer Clemens. Hi, Officer Clemens. Come in.
Especially when he put his feet in the pool with the black policemen.
That looks awfully enjoyable, but
I don't have a towel or anything.
Oh, you share mine.
Okay.
Sure.
Who can pull?
Have you ever heard of a thing called fluoridation? Fluoridation of water?
Yes, I have heard of that, Jack, yes.
The Birch Society argued that fluoride in the drinking water was a massive wedge for socialized medicine, which was spoofed in the Stanley Kubrick film Dr. Strangelove.
Do you realize that fluoridation is the most monstrously conceived and dangerous communist plot we have ever had to face?
As long as I can remember, we did not drink the tap water in our house. We would fill up the back of our station wagon with 50 empty water jugs, and we would go up to Oyster Bay. There was like a spigot, and it was considered like very good spring water.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Joe Pine.
One of their most infamous conspiracy theories that exploded into the public conscious was the Birch founder, Robert Welch, accused Dwight Eisenhower of being an agent of the communist conspiracy.
And here was the leader of this new group questioning the patriotism of the man that the people of America sent twice to the White House.
Mm-hmm.
Some nights when you go to bed and before you close your eyes and sleep, don't you say to yourself, damn it, Bob, I wish I hadn't said that about Eisenhower?
No, I don't.
The Birch Society grew to 60 to 100,000 members. It was all over the country.
Not for many years has the issue of political extremism been given the attention it's getting in this presidential year.
The 1964 Republican convention was pretty raucous, tense atmosphere. Republicans from all over the country came to the Cow Palace in San Francisco. There was a major ideological clash of extremism and moderation within the Republican Party.
The governor of the state of New York, Governor Rockefeller.
Nelson Rockefeller had lost the nomination. As soon as he gets up to the microphone, he has this really uncomfortable smile on his face. I think he understands that he is facing a deeply hostile crowd, including some members of the John Birch Society, who really hated him. He mentions the Birchers and denounces extremism.
It is essential that this convention repudiate here and now any doctrine, any doctrinaire militant minority, whether communist, Ku Klux Klan, or Bircher.
The crowd is booing him. They're saying, we want Barry. We want Barry. Barry Goldwater, who was really seen as the hero of modern conservatism, he's associated with being the Birch candidate. He made a full-throated, very unusual defense of extremism.
I would remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. That was a very strong statement, probably earned more votes than anything else during the whole campaign.
Goldwater won the nomination, but in the election, he lost in one of the greatest landslides in American political history. Lyndon Johnson just crushed him. Many commentators at the time thought that this was the death knell of extremism.
And now, Eric Severide, maybe you can give us some views of what's been happening to extremism.
One question is this. Does this mean that their presence in this campaign with so much noise has immunized us against this kind of strong emotional poison, almost one could call it? Or have their activities rather desensitized us and lowered our moral standards in politics so that we've come to expect this kind of thing? I must confess, I don't know what the answer is.
When I first started back in the 60s, they thought I was wacko. That used to bother me more than it does today, because now there's a change in public opinion about conspiracies. People recognize that, wait a minute, conspiracies are common. I think they're becoming aware that many of the most important things we really believe in, many of them are lies. They're illusions.
The Birch Society as an organization still exists today. You can see elements of Birch conspiracy theories about a deep state or the New World Order, as it's referred to by Alex Jones or Steve Bannon, really echo Birch conspiracy theories as well. As an organization, they have shriveled, but their ideas, I think, have become mainstream.
This story was produced by Nellie Gillis of Radio Diaries and edited by Deborah George. You can find more stories like this on the Radio Diaries podcast. In some of the, well, less stressful corners of social media, you can hear all kinds of bird calls, people sharing recordings of birds that they took with their phones. But 10-year-old Samuel Henderson of Oklahoma did not capture these sounds on his phone or a recorder. He made them himself.
Oh, no!
He's a passionate bird lover who's begun to draw crowds with his talent for imitating a wide range of calls. Joining us now is the expert bird caller himself, fourth grader Samuel Henderson, as well as his mother, Lori Henderson. Samuel, welcome to All Things Considered.
Thanks.
How old were you when you realized, wow, I can really imitate a lot of birds?
I was 6 years old.
Do you remember what bird it was that you first tried to imitate the sound?
Yeah, it was the great-tailed grackle, a shiny black bird with a long tail and yellow eyes.
What is it about birds that you love so much that makes you want to spend time studying them and listening to them?
Well, for some reason all of a sudden I just got into birds, and one of my most favorite features is that they have very unique calls and they can fly.
Yeah. Now let's talk about your bird calls. How many bird calls can you do at this point?
Well, over 50, but I don't know how many exactly.
Can you tell us what you do when you decide to learn a new one, how you practice it, how long it can take to say, like, I've got it just right?
Well, actually, it just takes a day or sometimes a few days, like, the resplendent quetzal, it took me a few days, or actually like a week, to figure it out and memorize its call, and now I perfected it.
Really? Can I hear that? That's really good. You know, I think one of the things that really got so much attention when you did your talent show and did all of these bird calls at school is just how many different, wildly different sounds that you're able to easily do. Let's listen to a moment from that performance and then talk about it.
And everyone, please hold your applause until after my performance, please. This is a red-tailed hawk.
You're doing owls, you're doing large birds, you're doing small birds, and how do you know what sounds to make and how to get that perfect sound just right when you're practicing?
Well, I go outside and sometimes I hear the call. There's this app on my phone called the Merlin Bird App.
Oh, I have that app too. I love it.
A week back on Saturday, I caught a northern flicker.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and then I learned the northern flicker call that day.
Oh, wow. Can I hear that one too? It almost sounds like you've got a kazoo or something, but that's just you.
Yeah. Well, I actually do have a kazoo in my bedroom.
Oh, okay. Can I talk to your mom for a couple minutes and ask her some questions?
Hang on. She's coming.
Okay.
She was just closing the door because my bird yelled out from my northern flicker call.
Oh, your bird responded to your call?
Yeah.
Does that happen a lot?
Yeah. Usually when I mimic his call, he copies back.
Okay.
So my mom's here.
Hey, is this Lori? Scott, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm good. We're really enjoying this conversation. Thanks for being willing to do it.
Well, thanks for having us.
How did you respond when you posted this and saw it take it off in the way that it has?
I was not going to post it. I delayed because it was back in May. And then, like a lot of kids, they like to put videos on themselves and things. And I said, okay, I'll put it on. I posted it at night. The next morning I got up and my jaw dropped.
One thing I did want to ask is in the post you included the hashtag autism. Why did you think that was important to include?
It is important to get that out there, the uniqueness that these kids and individuals have. He looks at the world in a whole different view. He's made us, you know, look at the world in a different view and see the wonderful things that he can do. Just birds is his thing, and nurturing that aspect of somebody and not holding them back of what they love.
Yeah.
And that's why I did that hashtag.
Samuel Henderson, I just want to know, do you think that you want to do something related to birds as a career one day?
Yes, I want to be an ornithologist, study birds.
Well, you are off to a really great start. That is Samuel Henderson. We also talked to his mother, Lori Henderson, joining us from Oklahoma City. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. California just passed the country's first set of state-level reparations laws. At the same time, other related policies, like compensating people who lost property through eminent domain, died or were vetoed in the California Statehouse. Cap Radio's Megan Myskowski in Sacramento reports lawmakers are hoping that voters will keep this effort alive this week when they decide on whether or not to keep forced labor in state prisons.
On a recent morning in Sacramento, several advocacy groups are rallying to change the California Constitution. Cameron Nicole Cox with the ACLU California Action speaks to the crowd.
Slavery is inconsistent with California values.
That's right.
And even still, slavery is alive and well in detention and penal facilities across our great state.
This campaign is for Prop 6, a ballot measure to end forced labor in state prisons. Tens of thousands of prisoners in California have jobs, usually cooking or cleaning, that pay under $1 per hour. This is the last big push this year to get reparations for descendants of enslaved people on the books, in this case by addressing one legacy of slavery in the state. Five bills from the reparations package were signed into law, including measures that call for the state to make an official apology for slavery and curb discrimination of natural hairstyles in sports. Most of the reparations bills that lawmakers wrote this year didn't make it. Cox says that's disappointing.
We absolutely vote people in because we believe that they are going to advance certain policy. And then when they show us that they won't, we get to vote again.
Observers say that the setbacks showed getting the most impactful policies through is going to take a while. Legislators didn't even consider direct cash payments this year. Aria Florent is the co-founder of Liberation Ventures, which tracks the progress of dozens of reparations efforts across the nation.
Every movement, it doesn't always move in a linear fashion, right?
She was hoping to see California set a high precedent and says not getting all the bills approved was disappointing, but it's a start. Her organization partnered with researchers at Princeton University on a poll gauging support for reparations in the U.S. Most Americans still don't support them, and only 11% think direct cash payments will ever happen. Governor Gavin Newsom is a proponent of the idea of reparations. He still vetoed some of the bills, saying they weren't ready or too costly. Others died in the legislature. Senator Stephen Bradford from the greater Los Angeles area is a member of the California Black Legislative Caucus. He authored some of the bills that didn't make it. One addressed race-based use of eminent domain, and another would have created a department to implement the new laws. He says the effort should have had more teeth.
We had great momentum until the last week of session and for the real substantive stuff to really help stand up reparations.
California's budget includes $12 million for undefined reparations work this year. He admits that's not much, but he counts that money as a win. Assemblymember Corey Jackson is also a member of the caucus, and he says a lot of people aren't even on the same page about what reparations should look like.
You even look at your own family, right? And you try to make a decision. Everybody ain't gonna agree.
He says his priority was to teach people about the model of reparations the caucus is looking to, which eventually includes cash payments, but starts with acknowledgement and an apology. This Tuesday, California voters will decide if that also means ending forced labor in prisons. For NPR News, I'm Megan Myskowski in Sacramento.
This is NPR News.
In election season, it can be confusing to sort out what's real and what's not. So before you share a post about the election, remember to think about the intention behind it.
A lot of misleading information is created intentionally to sow confusion or to create an emotional reaction.
A guide to help you avoid sharing election misinformation on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. Available online anytime for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for All Things Considered here on a Sunday afternoon. You know, one of the real treats of the holiday season is KPR's Big Band Christmas with the Kansas City Jazz Orchestra. It's Saturday, December 14th at Liberty Hall, featuring a night of Kansas City swing, Christmas carols, and dancing. Tickets are going fast at the Liberty Hall box office and Ticketmaster.com. Find all the details over at kansaspublicradio.org. Tonight in Northeast and East Central Kansas, we have a 30% chance of showers, skies cloudy, a low of 60 degrees. Showers likely form 67. Chance of showers and possibly a thunderstorm after 10 a.m. tomorrow night, 90% chance of showers. and a low of 48 degrees. You know, when your old car or truck is no longer your favorite place to listen to KPR, consider donating it to KPR. Learn about our Vehicles for Charity program at that website, KansasPublicRadio.org. You're listening to KPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Linda Moodbell Learning Centers, online instruction available anytime, anywhere for students to catch up or get ahead in reading, comprehension, and math. LindaMoodbell.com/NPR. From Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Catherine Hahn loves being a witch. She gets to play one as Agatha Harkness in the Disney Plus show Agatha All Along. She says the role allows her to portray a ton of impulses that women don't always get to express.
You can be big with your emotions. You can be angry. You can take up as much space as you need. You can be like, not that I would be casually cruel, but to be able to play that is just like selfish. All the stuff.
Hahn has spent her career playing characters whose Agatha-like impulses are usually just under the surface, fighting to come out. You can see it in her roles in everything from Step Brothers to Transparent to Mrs. Fletcher. Hahn joined NPR's Rachel Martin on Wildcard, the game where cards control the conversation. Here's Rachel.
What period of your life do you often daydream about?
Well, I guess it depends on the chapter I'm in. Like right now, as my son is turning 18 on Friday, I think it is that period of like his preschool, and like before, like I'm so back in that place of just playing with him until dinner, like that like weird post nap before dinner, like the sun's kind of going down. You're trying to find things to do. What if I start crying? But like, you also can't believe it's another night you've had to go through. Like, it's the same.
No, I know. Those hours were really hard for me.
And when I think about them, beautiful.
Yeah, literally the witching. Yeah, the witching hour. Like, the sun would go down and we'd be like, no, we have to do it again. But like, that little time before dinner that was always like, sometimes you would walk into it like dreading it, but then it's still, now, of course, I'm so nostalgic. What was the thing that you would do? What was your go-to?
We would look for bugs in the front yard. We made like a little, you know, fairy village by the tree in the back. Like we would try to play and just taking a little walk sometimes, like, yeah. And just chatting. It was just the best. Like what I wouldn't give now to have those like. And again, like when you're in the middle of it, you're like, but those moments now are like coming to the surface and I daydream about them. Yeah. To know that those like running down the stairs late in the morning and like all that stuff, it's like that, it's just that noise is going to become like memory, which is you can't believe it.
Three more cards. I'm going to do that first card.
This one?
Mm-hmm.
Number one. Have you ever had a premonition about something that came true?
Oh, I don't even want to say it out loud. I'm going to think of another one.
Yeah, you don't have to tell me that one.
But
you've had them.
Yeah, I definitely have had them. Yeah. Yeah. You know, when there have been times where the phone rings and I know what it's about before I pick it up. Like my dad passed away this spring and it was like a random phone call on like a Monday night. And I saw a 216 number, which is the area code from Cleveland. I didn't recognize it as my uncle's. And I was like, okay. And he'd been doing okay. Like, so, you know, it wasn't like I was always expecting this call. I mean, I guess you are, in a sense, always due when your parents are getting up there and you're not living with them. But I just had a feeling.
Yeah, it's definitely happened to me before. And yeah, some of them are things you don't want to say out loud because they were so fragile and precious and maybe sad.
Yes.
But it always, strangely, even when they're hard things, it makes me feel, I don't know, more connected.
That is exactly the word I was going to say. Like that we were, our like higher powers were connected.
Yeah.
You know, I was able to be there when he passed, which meant so much. He passed away like 3 hours after we got there. Like, so it was all supposed to unfold exactly it was, but it did. I think those moments do reveal that subconscious connection you have to a loved one.
Three more cards.
Okay, great.
One, two, three.
Two.
Mm-hmm. What life transition has been challenging?
Oof. Well, I was going to say the one I'm in right now. This particular chapter in a woman's life into the next portal, like through the next portal where, you know, she's not as fertile in the literal sense, has been a very unexpectedly challenging time.
We're talking about menopause.
Yes.
Yeah.
Pause in the moon. But like, no one talks about it. So you kind of walk into it blind. Mm-hmm. So I was like, oof, do I feel like myself? Like, who is this? Like, who's coming through right now? Like my moods, my like,
right. And how much everything. Of it is you and how much of it is
it's the hormones.
Yeah. You don't know. Yeah. I know.
You know, now, and I think somewhat this show is also kind of a metaphor for that of like, you know, breaking through as a woman to find your power, looking for your power at the end of the road.
I imagine for actors in Hollywood, it is doubly complicated because you start getting people, the producers see you in a different light and you're to them, you're losing your power. You're losing your virility, your sexuality or charisma or something. And this doesn't feel like that. This feels like an affirmation. This role feels like an affirmation of those things.
100%.
Yeah.
I, though, because my currency in this business wasn't my sex appeal, I feel like I've been able to just kind of walk into more complicated parts. Mm-hmm. And I am eternally grateful for that. Like, I really don't feel powerless. I feel like actually more powerful than I did in my 20s or early 30s in this business. I definitely feel I have more say. I'm definitely not as afraid to say it, which is really freeing.
Catherine Hahn, she stars as Agatha Harkness in the new Disney Plus show Agatha All Along. Catherine, thank you for doing this.
Oh, thank you so much. This is like so rich and so fun.
Follow NPR's Wildcard podcast to hear a longer version of that conversation. The Cure, the English rock band that for decades has ruled over a dark and mysterious corner of music, has just released its first album in 16 years. Songs of a Lost World is moody and dramatic and also romantic and melodic. All of this should be music to the ears of fans who have loved the band since the 80s when they were releasing albums with names like Disintegration and Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me. So what does The Cure offer listeners in 2024? NPR music critic and correspondent Ann Powers is here to talk us through the new album. Hey, Ann.
Hey, Scott. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm a little surprised by this. Is it fair to call this a surprise?
Well, yes and no. I mean, The Cure's been playing songs that are on this album on tour for a while, and fans knew it was coming. But what is a surprise, I think, is that this is one of the best rock albums of the year. It might be the best rock album of the year. I mean, the music sounds right in line with The Cure's classic albums like Disintegration, but it still sounds totally fresh and relevant. Like the song And Nothing Is Forever. Promise you'll be with me in the end. Say we'll I mean, part of it is that this is really a band album. I mean, Robert Smith, the main guy in The Cure, he did write all of the songs on this record. But even though the group hasn't released an album since 2008, this version of the band's been touring with basically the same lineup for more than a decade. And man, they are tight. They are on fire. I want to shout out the rhythm section in particular. The drummer, Jason Cooper, and the bassist, Simon Gallup, they just keep this engine running even when the songs get really huge.
Let's talk about Robert Smith, though, for a moment, because one of those guys who just seemed old for his time in his 20s, right? Now he's 65.
Icon of ennui.
Now he's 65, though, so how does that melancholy translate at this phase in the band's career?
Well, you know, Scott, sometimes with an artist, you think, wow, they were always meant to be where they're at now. Yeah. And that's, to me, the essence of this record. It turns out that the intensity that the band conjures in their songs, you know, songs that deal with death and loneliness and inner and global conflict, actually, it is perfect for someone who is 65. You know, I mean, it's really perfect for someone in a later chapter of his life. This album, Songs of a Lost World, addresses the deaths of several of his closest family members, his parents and his older brother, who was one of the guys who brought him into music. Mm-hmm. Smith's floating existential dread was always kind of his brand, you know? But now he's in a real face down with mortality, and that's very powerful. Like on this song, I Can Never Say Goodbye.
You know, The Cure is known for being gothy, but then they also have these huge hits like Friday I'm in Love, like a totally different sound. Any of that in this album?
I'm glad you brought that up. So basically, there's two Cures in one band. There's the fun, quirky, hit-making band, like you mentioned, you know, Friday I'm in Love. Those are fun songs. We love to hear them on our greatest hits of the 80s compilations or whatever. But then there's also this like totally locked in, almost metal level rock monster of a band whose songs just stretch out for 8 or 10 minutes at a time and who really take you on a psychedelic journey. And this album is in that camp. That's what you're getting with these songs. Even though there's still the essence of a hook in many of these songs. Okay. You will still sing along.
One thing The Cure hasn't really been over the years is a political band, right?
Mm,
though,
look, yeah.
Maybe a bit of a shift here with one particular song, War Song, that does address big, weighty issues. Is this a pivot?
Well, I thought it was when I heard the song, but then I did a little research and found that Smith has said that that song is about a relationship. Oh. You know, one of those friendships where you fall out and you make up and you fall out again. But the sound of it, to me, it just takes it to that bigger scale. I mean, it feels like a battleground when you're listening. And I, to me, it resonates about the global situation that we're all in.
And as much as I hate to say it, it's a long time from the 80s.
Yes.
It's a long time from that post-punk era where The Cure really made its mark. Why do we need this band now? What does The Cure have for us in 2024?
You know, The Cure offers us really immersive music dealing with the most like intense and difficult emotions that humans experience. And let's face it, we're in a challenging moment in history right now. And just falling into an album like this, for me, it helps me cope.
Well, that's a good thing.
Yeah, we need it.
That's NPR music critic and correspondent Ann Powers talking about the new album from The Cure called Songs of a Lost World. And you can hear more of her thoughts on the NPR music podcast, New Music Friday. Thanks a lot, Ann.
Thank you so much.
We are going to close the show with a news story hanging over everything. The presidential election that's just 2 days away. Vice President Harris and former President Donald Trump are campaigning in swing states, fighting for every vote in a neck-and-neck race. NPR's Luke Garrett joins us now for the latest. Hey, Luke.
Hey, Scott.
So let's start with Trump. He was in Pennsylvania this morning. What is Trump's closing argument?
Former President Trump rallied in Lancaster Airport in Pennsylvania this morning. In one of his final campaign speeches, Trump focused on claims that this election is being stolen.
We got a lot of crooked people out there. We're fighting like a son of a gun. We're fighting. They are fighting so hard to steal this damn thing.
Now, without evidence, Trump cast doubt on voting machines, saying they can be hacked. He then cited tech billionaire Elon Musk, who has been spreading election disinformation on his social media platform X. Later on in his speech, when discussing the possibility of a third assassination attempt, Trump talked about reporters being shot at.
To get me, somebody would have to shoot through the fake news. And I don't mind that so much.
Now, in a quick statement from the Trump campaign director of communications, Stephen Chung, he said that Trump wasn't wishing violence on reporters, but instead, quote, looking out for their welfare far more than his own, end quote.
What about Harris? What is her closing message?
Whether it's Harris's comedic cameo on Saturday Night Live or her symbolic speech at the Ellipse in Washington, D.C. last week, the overall message remains really clear. Turn the page on Trump. But underneath this closing argument, the Harris campaign is using its final hours to really galvanize key voting blocks. Today, for the fourth Sunday in a row, Harris spoke to a black church in a swing state. Here's Harris with a congregation in Detroit, Michigan.
And in these next 2 days, we will be tested. These days will demand everything we've got.
And tonight, Harris rallies with Michigan State University students in East Lansing, Michigan. Young and black voters in particular hold the keys to a Harris win, according to top members of her campaign.
So it's a close race. Tens of millions of people have already voted. What are the candidates doing with the remaining hours looking ahead?
So both candidates are really focusing on messages that their bases like in hopes of squeezing out every last vote in an election that could come down to tens of thousands of votes in a handful of states.
That is NPR's Luke Garrett. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that is all things considered for this Sunday. NPR will be covering the final days of this race. And of course, we will be here Tuesday night as the results start to come in. We hope you'll join us then. And we hope you have a great night tonight.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Subaru, featuring the 2024 Subaru Crosstrek Wilderness with off-road capability and 9.3 inches of ground clearance designed for adventure seekers. Learn more at Subaru.com/wilderness. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, FM 91.5. KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, FM 89.7. KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, FM 91.3. KANQ Chanute, FM 90.3. K210 CR in Atchison, 89.9. And K258BT in Manhattan, 99.5. And we're always online for you at KansasPublicRadio.org. Thanks for joining us here on a Sunday afternoon. KPR's Community Spotlight is now accepting applications from local nonprofits who need help spreading awareness about their mission. We'll highlight your organization for a month using KPR's airwaves. All the details are at that website, kansaspublicradio.org. 30% chance of showers tonight in northeast and east central Kansas. Skies cloudy, a low of 60 degrees. Showers likely for tomorrow. High of 67, a chance of thunderstorms after 10 a.m., 90% chance of showers for Monday night, the low of 48. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
Okay, this isn't news to anybody. Our country is profoundly, cataclysmically divided, disagreeing about so many basic things. The COVID vaccine, was the last election stolen, was January 6th an insurrection, or as they called it on Tucker Carlson's show, a grandma selfie party. It's two different visions of reality that seem doomed to never reconcile. And maybe this is an inappropriate comparison, but somehow this comes to mind for me. You know that thing in your personal life where you get into a serious fight with somebody who you really care about, and they see it one way, and you see it another way, and you're not seeing eye to eye? The best outcome, the thing you hope for, is that by talking it through, and really listening to each other and trying to sort it out. In the end, you'll either see it the same way, you'll have the same story, or, this is almost as good, you won't agree on what happened. But at least you'll get where the other person's coming from, and they'll get where you're coming from, and neither of you thinks the other's crazy or has ill intent. I just wish we could do that with our politics. I understand all the reasons why that's not happening. I understand how some people think, well, way beyond that, it's impossible, counterproductive, just a bad idea. But just to say, I wish. I think lots of us wish that. Without that, and, you know, divided so evenly, nobody can predict the outcome of a presidential election. Without that, how are we going to keep functioning as a country? But who's trying to bridge that gap between red America and blue America and bring us to a common story? I honestly can't name a half dozen people if I try. And so whenever I hear of anybody attempting to do anything like that and doing what seems like a decent job of it, I perk up. And I heard about somebody like that recently from somebody who used to work here at our show, Brian Reed. They did a story on this new podcast that he started with another former This American Life producer, Robin Semyon. Robin produces the show. Brian hosts it. And they did a story about somebody doing this. And Brian knows how I have kind of a bee in my bonnet about this particular thing. And so he sent me a copy. And I am very excited to present a version of their story for you right now. Because it gave me a glimpse, like a very tentative first step kind of glimpse. And I know that's a mixed metaphor, but just whatever. A first step glimpse of the possibility that people in this country could listen to each other a little bit and look at the facts of something together and understand each other just maybe a little smudge better. We have some other stories in today's program. They're about couples managing their feelings during this heightened political moment on the verge of all of us getting one president or another, one future or another. We're going to get to all that after the break. From WBEZ Chicago, this is American Life. I'm Ira Glass. Stay with us.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. 91.5 Lawrence, 89.7 Emporia, and always online at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for This American Life here on a Sunday evening. We're in the final stretch of this historic election season. Former President Trump and Vice President Harris are making their last big push before it all comes to a head on Tuesday. Join NPR and Kansas Public Radio for special live coverage of Election Night 2024. Our coverage begins Tuesday night at 6 p.m. on all KPR1 stations. Tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, 30% chance of showers, skies cloudy, a low of 60 degrees. Showers likely for tomorrow, a chance of thunderstorms after 10 a.m., a high of 67, 90% chance of showers on Monday night. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
It's This American Life, Act One, a tiny thing that gives me hope. Okay, so like I said before the break, this is a story about somebody trying to bridge the gap in the way that red America and blue America see the world. And like I said, it comes from this new podcast that Brian Reed is hosting called Question Everything. It's a podcast about journalism, and the person trying to bridge the gap between the two Americas in this story is a journalist. In the story that they did on the podcast, they get to that guy in a little bit. But the story starts with a couple, Dick and Emily, who found themselves unhappily living on opposite sides of the red-blue divide. When they first met decades ago, he was a Republican. She was, she says, a bleeding heart liberal, but it wasn't a big deal. And then that changed. Here's Brian with one of the producers of Question Everything, Zach St. Louis.
So, Zach, you're the one who's gotten to know Dick and Emily, this couple that was fighting over the news, right?
Yeah. So their names are Richard and Emily Newton. He obviously goes by Dick. They're in their 70s. They just celebrated their 24th wedding anniversary. It's a second marriage, both of them. They fell in love singing hymns together in the choir at church. She's an alto. He's a bass.
That's sweet. Where do they live?
They live in Orange County, California.
Okay.
And over the last several years, they've found that they've been growing more and more miserable over something that seems so basic, which is what news they would each want to read in the morning.
We get up and get a cup of coffee and we sit down and we start going through our emails. And we sit next to each other when we're doing that. I'd say, Emily, I have an article here. Would you be interested in me sending it to you? And she would say, who's it from? And if I said Breitbart News or...
Breitbart? Is that what you mean?
Breitbart. That's it. Yeah, Breitbart. Or Epic Times. She knew those were really right-leaning and wasn't really interested. I was the same way with her. She found something on Atlantic or New York Times or Washington Post.
Dick doesn't trust anything, no matter what it is, that comes from the New York Times, the Washington Post.
The Atlantic.
The Atlantic.
MSNBC.
CNN. That's
CNN is another.
So anything, it doesn't matter what they're saying. He just automatically dismisses.
Well, they developed their own reputation.
Okay. I realize we are not reading from the same hymnal here.
So they told me that they started arguing a lot more when Trump came on the political scene. Dick supported Trump. Emily furiously did not. But then it was after Election Day in 2020 when they had one of their biggest disagreements.
From the beginning, I never believed that the election was fraudulently stolen. I have more faith in people and in our democracy. Dick was more open to doubt.
They were saying that there was a lot of things that were going on that shouldn't have been going on. There was packing drop boxes with ballots. One person would walk up to the ballot box and drop in all kinds of ballots into it.
So this particular theory Dick's talking about, it's from a movie, one of the many sources that he was turning to at the time. It's called 2,000 Mules. Have you heard of it?
I've heard of it. Yes, I've had people talk to me about it, as I've been reporting, basically.
Yeah, so this movie, 2,000 Mules, it looks like a documentary, but it's really a propaganda film. It's about a stolen election theory. It's not true, but for a while on the right, this movie seemed like it was everywhere. Everyone seemed to be talking about it. Trump actually did a screening of it at Mar-a-Lago. It was in something like 400 movie theaters. I mean, lots and lots of people believed it. It's made by Dinesh D'Souza. He's a right-wing political commentator.
All right, what's the gist?
The gist is that it's about this theory that a bunch of Democratic groups were paying people, who they call mules, to illegally collect ballots and stuff them into ballot boxes in key swing states.
Philadelphia alone, we've identified more than 1,100 mules.
So there are these talking head interviews, and they're intercut with this grainy surveillance footage that shows, like, this person, like, putting ballots into a box, and they're like, see, there's all the evidence you need.
But that's not real surveillance footage, or?
It is real surveillance footage, but it's showing people just dropping off ballots legally. And when Dick watched it, like a lot of people, he thought it seemed really plausible.
It just added to the other stories that I was hearing, things that were happening in Arizona and Georgia. I'm thinking, yeah, there's stuff going on here that shouldn't be going on.
So Dick is watching this movie. He's reading his sources. And there are so many sources that cite so many stories about election fraud, which is part of what made it so believable.
And also, he's watching the president, President Trump, say over and over again that the election was fraudulent and had been stolen from him.
Yes, exactly. And then Emily's consuming all of her own sources, and they say the exact opposite. And it all added to this feeling that it wasn't safe for them to talk about politics. Did that feel different from other arguments or disagreements you'd had about non-political things over your marriage?
It did, because there was no give and take. We can argue about, you know, what we're going to spend our money on. We can argue about our kids. You know, we can argue about the neighborhood. But we usually come to some sort of resolution. This whole thing about Trump, there's no resolution.
How did that feel?
Frustrating. Because I know my husband. I know what a smart, sensitive, thoughtful person he is. He's very generous. I know all that about him. And to have him suddenly be aligned to this person who I found absolutely despicable was very troubling.
She wouldn't talk to me. She basically just, I don't want to talk about it. I would try, but it wasn't going to happen. And if it did, we'd end up yelling at each other. I got so angry with her one day that I just had to walk out of the house and walk down the street to cool off. And then I started thinking, wow, I'm letting politics get involved in our marriage, because I was really angry at the time. And I just couldn't stand that. I never thought that politics was important enough to jeopardize what she and I had together.
Did you feel like that it could do that, that politics could jeopardize it?
Yes, I really did. I think, what did I get myself into here? Maybe I did something I shouldn't have done.
What's the mistake you're talking about?
Having someone that was so far left that I couldn't live with.
Oof. Yeah, this was a pretty low point in their marriage. And they told me that they really wanted to find a way out of it.
We were both looking for some sort of, I don't want to say neutral, but impartial news source.
I was hungry for something that I could count on to peel the layers away and really show what's in the heart of it.
They started reading different online news sources that branded themselves as being unbiased, slant-free, that kind of thing.
Interesting.
And then they finally landed on something. It was a newsletter. Dick seemed to like it okay. So did Emily.
We both agreed. Oh, yes. Let's read Tangle.
Tangle.
Yes. It's this daily newsletter. Comes to your email. It's like a Substack type thing. It's run by a guy named Isaac Saul. He started it. He writes it. They have about 135,000 subscribers. It comes to your inbox every weekday. And each issue is all about one topic from the news. What they try to do is summarize two or three of the best articles and arguments from right-leaning sources about that topic, and then they do the same thing with left-leaning sources. And the whole premise of the newsletter is that there are people out there, like Dick and Emily, that are reading completely separate sources, and why not put all of those in one place so you can actually read what those arguments are?
I think probably the first thing that astounded me was the transparency, that when they make a mistake, they correct it as soon as they realize it, and they put it right up front.
How is that different than corrections in a newspaper?
A little bit. It's the way that they do it. So corrections in a newspaper, you know, traditionally, they are at the end of the article. There'll be like a little footnote. Actually, we got this wrong. It's been changed above. We regret the error, you know, in like little print italics at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
Tangle's approach to corrections, it's a bit different.
Can you show me?
Yes. This is from August 21st. And at the very, very top, the very first thing that you see is correction. Period, in big letters.
Mm-hmm.
In our coverage of the Medicare drug pricing negotiations yesterday, we said that four of the Medicare Part D drugs for which the government had negotiated lower prices were overprescribed in the United States. That was false. We misread the abstract of a study and rushed our review process when we included it. A sincere thank you to the 10 or so readers who caught the error. And then in italics right below that, this is our 114th correction in Tangle's 263-week history and our first correction since August 13th. We track corrections and place them at the top of the newsletter in an effort to maximize transparency with readers.
So this is different than a newspaper, I see.
Yeah.
What else did Dick and Emily notice about Tangle?
Yeah, so they noticed that it wasn't so sensational. It was more measured or even-handed in their language. So, for instance, Tangle noticed that readers on the right would sometimes unsubscribe from the newsletter after reading a phrase like undocumented immigrant, but they also didn't think it was right to call someone illegal or an illegal alien. So they did this big internal review, and they settled on the term unauthorized migrant.
We really liked that approach, trying to filter out all the trigger words or the words that were very highly volatile emotionally, which helps both of us then consider the issue with less emotion about it. I'm not going to say with no emotion. We would still argue, but with less emotion about it. And then we loved Isaac's take.
What's Isaac's take?
So Isaac's take, Isaac refers to Isaac Saul. He's the founder and writer of the newsletter. Mm-hmm. And at the end of every issue, he spends a long time writing his opinion. And these can be long. And he says exactly how he feels about the issue after having researched it, and just describes his own feeling about it.
Wait, do you have an example of this?
Yeah, here, I'll send one to you. We can look at it.
All right, this was earlier this month. Hurricane Helene and the disaster relief efforts.
Yes. The first part is just the topic. Then they summarize what the right is saying. They summarize what the left is saying. But then at the end, you see my take. And so I'm obviously not going to read this whole thing. It is.
Yeah, this is long. Wow.
2,200 words, I looked.
It's like a whole essay. But what's his take on Hurricane Helene?
Yeah, so before we get to his take, I think you need to understand what he's responding to here. There have been a lot of attacks on the Biden administration from the right saying that they're doing nothing to help people who've been affected by this hurricane.
Like actually nothing.
Well, that they failed to rise to the occasion, basically. So Isaac, he really puts a stake in the ground and says there's a big problem with this narrative. It's all nonsense. It's all a lie. And then he writes, I hate writing pieces like this. It's not my job to defend the federal government from lies. And it's hard to write a piece like this without reading it like I'm openly shilling for Harris or Biden. I am not. I'm not here to do their PR or protect their reputations. However, I do care about our information ecosystem. I care about reliable, accurate information being shared widely. I also care about the North Carolinians in danger right now. Not just because they're Americans and it's a state I love, but also because my mom, my aunt, my brother and his family, my sister-in-law and my niece, they all live in North Carolina. So the horrors we're all witnessing on the news hit close to home. Here's the truth, though. Biden and Harris have actually pulled every lever federal executives can in a situation like this. None of the critics that I posted above can say exactly what they want them to do that they aren't already doing. And if you're planning on writing in to tell me that I am shilling for Harris or being a left-wing hack by calling out lies online, you better be prepared to tell me exactly what I've gotten wrong here. And he goes on for several more paragraphs.
Oh, wow. Interesting. I can feel his resentment at having to defend the Democratic administration.
Yeah. He's like, I don't want to do this just to defend them. But in this case, they're doing everything they can. And that's what the facts show. And so I'm going to say that.
Right.
And this part of the newsletter was something that Dick and Emily really came to appreciate.
He was very clear about what his biases were. That made him extremely trustworthy. More often than not, when we get to the end and we read my take, we look at each other and say, yeah, that's how I feel.
They started realizing that they actually agreed with each other on a lot of things, and they were able to talk about it. And eventually, something pretty remarkable happened. So remember how Dick was totally convinced the election had been stolen? He watched 2,000 Mules. He read all of those conspiracies about it.
Mm-hmm.
So as Dick and Emily were starting to have this shared understanding of the news again, Tingle did the thing for Dick that no other source seemed to be able to do, that Emily wasn't able to do. And that was proved to him that the 2020 election had not been stolen.
The only thing that changed my mind completely was the fact that I started reading Tangle. And it's only because I trust Isaac and his team so much.
It's incredibly fulfilling, to be honest.
This is Isaac Saul.
He's the guy who writes Tangle.
Yes.
Just like it's actually like so rewarding because the election fraud stuff in particular was one of the most difficult times of my life as a reporter. The month after that election was like dark, stressful, really, really hard work. And hearing that somebody had that reaction, that their mind was actually changed, even one person, it's like, yeah, it makes me want to cry.
So am I getting this right? It seems like Isaac and this newsletter Tangle, they seem to have done something that I feel like so many journalists, myself included, have been banging our heads against the wall, trying to figure out what to do, which is how do you get people to believe the evidence that the 2020 election was not stolen from Donald Trump? Something like a third of Americans believe it was. It's really threatening our ability to function. How do you present those facts and get people to believe them?
Yeah.
And you're saying Tangle did it.
In this case, Tangle did it. Yeah, for Dick, Tangle did it.
All right, so how did Tangle do this? How did Isaac, the guy who runs this, do this?
Yeah, so Isaac did a ton of work around this whole election denialism issue. It wasn't just one newsletter. Every time a new claim about how the election may have been stolen surfaced, he would spend all this time running it down, explaining in detail why it was false. He did that in the days and weeks immediately following the election. He continued doing it as new claims surfaced in the years since.
But a lot of news sources have done this, you know, looked at these different claims about how the election was stolen and showed why they aren't true and looked at the court cases where no evidence surfaced and all this stuff, right?
They did. But Isaac was doing a lot of research. Like, for example, in the weeks following the election, right after, he did this 400-tweet-long thread detail into each claim. He was really, really deep on this. But I don't think it was only the research that helped convince Dick. There's something else that Isaac did. And it was in his tone and how he approached this whole issue. especially around the claims that seemed more persuasive, he didn't just write them off. He assessed them seriously, he presented them seriously, and that didn't make Dick feel stupid. Here's Isaac.
Some of the stuff was really convincing, and proving that they were wrong was not as simple as saying, like, oh, this is just like conspiracy nonsense. Like the ballot stuffing thing, that was a plausible way to steal an election.
In 2022, he actually dedicated an entire newsletter, a deep dive into 2000 Mules, that movie we were talking about.
So when that movie came out and everybody just like laughs at Dinesh D'Souza, I was kind of like, I'm going to watch it and like take some of these allegations seriously and see what's up. It turned out they're all bullshit, but like you only know that if you actually do some of the work.
Can I actually just read you what he wrote at the top of that newsletter?
Yeah, please.
So the title of the newsletter is An Honest Look at 2000 Mules, The New Stolen Election Theory. And this is how he opens it. I consider myself to be both a skeptic and an open-minded person. I am deeply cynical about our government, believe intelligence agencies are covering up the truth about UFOs, and don't feel any particular loyalty to any major political parties. I generally distrust authority, government agencies, and politicians, but I do believe it's wise to consult expert opinions and advice. I love a good conspiracy, a good cover-up, and a great story. A stolen presidential election would be an all-timer in every regard. A story so gigantic, a conspiracy of corruption and power so unthinkable that the idea alone is tantalizing enough, I almost want to believe it. And then he goes on to dissect every point made in the film and show why it's inaccurate. But that's how he starts.
Interesting. Okay, so that's the presentation difference you're talking about?
Yeah, and I'll just say that that framing, it's really different from how other outlets covered this film. Like, for example, there's a New York Times headline about the movie. It was, quote, a big lie in a new package. There was a Washington Post headline that was, quote, 2000 Mules offers the least convincing election fraud theory yet. And look, I mean, that's all true. It is a lie. But Isaac realized he's probably not going to convince someone who already believes the lie by leading with that. So instead, he levels with people, explains where he's coming from and all the research he did, and then explains what he found about the claims. And so this was what Dick was reading.
After reading his article, what I realized was, and he even admitted, there were some things that were happening that shouldn't have been happening in some of the polls. But it wouldn't have changed the dynamics of who won and who lost at all. That was actually the first time I really realized it for sure. And that really opened my eyes to how corrupt that was. That really sold me on the fact that the election wasn't stolen.
What I was thinking in my head was like, I want to bring all these people in my life under one roof, and I want them to be able to read a news source that like the, you know, Trump MAGA bro will trust and like the left wing Bernie bro will trust.
What was the like origin story for Tangle, for Isaac? Like, he was a reporter before this?
Yeah, he was a reporter. He worked for Huffington Post, a couple of other places. And he told me that he's always been the type of person that's brought together people from different backgrounds in his personal life. Maybe they don't agree, and he's often mediating between those people. But really, the inspiration for Tangle came out of his own news consumption.
The idea for Tangle basically came from the Trump era of, like, Trump proposes a border wall, and I'm like, he's, like, proposing a 2,000-mile border wall. This sounds totally insane. I can't imagine the best argument for this, but I really want to understand, is this something that would actually work? And in order to grasp what was actually happening, my day would be like, I'm going to go read the New York Times editorial board. I'm going to read their immigration reporting about it. Then I'm going to go to Fox News and, you know, scroll through their opinion page and search for Trump's border wall. And then maybe I'll listen to like a Ben Shapiro podcast, and then I'll go listen to Pod Save America. And then, you know, I'll watch The Daily Show do a bit about it, or watch John Oliver. And then I'll spend like an hour on, you know, some Tucker Carlson special about it. And then I'll do like 10 hours of all this consuming the news, and I'll sit down and I'll be like, okay, I think I now have a really good understanding of everybody's perspective, positive and negative, about this policy proposal. Why can't I just find that one place? That should exist somewhere.
Do you know who's reading the newsletter?
I kind of do based on a reader survey of Tangle subscribers. So a little bit over half of the subscribers are men, around 57%. It skews very white, just below 90% of readers. It's U.S.-based, but Isaac says it does reach something like 55 other countries. And about a third of the readers say that they're on the left, a third on the right, and the last third are either center or independent.
Wow, so it's pretty evenly politically split.
Yeah, pretty even split politically. And I did talk to some other readers of the newsletter who said that it had an impact on them, similar to Dick and Emily.
Like who?
I met this one guy at like a political event in New York, and he told me it's basically the only news that he reads. I talked to a new reader of Tangle, a journalist actually, and he said that there were some arguments from the right that he'd just written off. But reading Tangle actually helped him see that they had a point. And I even spoke to another guy who, like Dick, had his mind changed about the 2020 election.
I assumed that Donald Trump was telling me the truth, that they had firm evidence that there was definitely manipulation of the ballots.
This is a guy named Rick.
Wait, Rick and Dick?
Rick and Dick.
Okay.
Both Richard, if you want to be technical about it.
Got it. Go on.
It's a really similar story to Dick and Emily's. Rick was a big Trump supporter, voted for him twice. Rick's son is on the left politically. They were arguing about the news a lot. And the son started forwarding Rick the newsletter, including issues that were about the stolen election claims.
They weren't just laughing it off. I have a trust in their news gathering and presentation abilities head and shoulders above any other news gathering source. I have a trust level there that's unequaled.
And again, like Dick and Emily, Rick and his son have mended their relationship. They can talk to each other about the news again. And now he doesn't think the election was stolen. And that feeling of being lied to, it's actually convinced him not to vote for Trump this year.
Really?
Yeah, the only reason I wouldn't vote for him because he made me look foolish in front of my son.
You know, Zach, you mentioned the importance of striking the right tone when we're presenting evidence, especially evidence that's like contrary to what someone believes.
Mm.
And that does seem important, but also, you know, just hearing the story of Rick and his son alongside the story of Dick and Emily, his wife, like I do just wonder, does a person have to be motivated to get along with someone they love, to repair a relationship essentially, in order to change their mind?
Yeah, it's a good question. Wanting to see something from someone else's perspective, the perspective of someone you love, it seems like that doesn't hurt.
You know, it's interesting thinking about it. It's not exactly that Tangle moved both of them towards the center and they met in the middle, but it moved Dick more towards Emily, basically.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it would make for a better story if they each moved toward the center. I think that's sort of
met in the middle.
What we want from a story like this. Exactly, met in the middle. But it's really more like Dick believed something that wasn't true, and then he was the one that moved toward facts.
How does Emily say it changed her? Like, does she say it changed her?
So she told me that she didn't have as dramatic a change as Dick. It wasn't like she believed something that wasn't true and had her mind changed. But she says she does read the news differently now. For instance, she told me that hearing some of Kamala Harris's policy proposals and how before she would have taken some of them at face value as good ideas. Now she says she's thinking more critically about them.
Hmm. How are they doing these days?
Yeah, the last time I spoke to them, they really did seem to be in a better place. I think on the surface, it seemed like their problem was that they've been talking across this political divide. But their real problem was that they weren't agreeing on facts. They weren't agreeing on what was true. That's what made it so bitter.
It's a huge relief. Dick and I can now agree on more or disagree based on the same information, at least.
I don't feel like I'm walking on eggshells if I want to mention something to her. I mean, she's her own person. I'm not going to tell her who to vote for, and she wouldn't listen to me anyway.
Now we're on the same hymn book, more or less, although he might be reading a different page than me at the time, but it's generally the same hymn book.
But I mean, agreeing on the same set of facts, being in the same book, that's only going to get you so far.
Who's Dick voting for?
You know, as far as I'm concerned, I don't like Trump as a person. The way he handles himself, the things he says, it bothers me a lot. But the one thing that I did like about him was his policies. And so I'm definitely leaning towards Trump still.
Okay, that's Dick's take.
That's my take.
That's the first time that he's
verbalized to me that he's thinking about voting for Trump, my heart just stopped.
Emily and Dick Newton in Orange County, California.
So that's Brian Reed and Zach St. Louis of the podcast Question Everything, which is produced by KCRW and Placement Theory. The story was edited by Jonathan Goldstein and Robin Semyon. Coming up, other couples muddling their way through this election using slightly more extreme tactics. That's in a minute from Chicago Public Radio when our program continues.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence, 91.3 Junction City, and always online for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for This American Life here on a Sunday evening. When you think of the most dangerous abolitionist in Kansas history, you probably think of John Brown. Tonight on KPR Presents, the most dangerous abolitionist you probably haven't heard of before. Todd Melfeld and David Schaefer join Kay McIntyre for KPR Presents, 6 o'clock this evening, here on Kansas Public Radio. 30% chance of showers tonight in northeast and east central Kansas. Skies cloudy, a low of 60 degrees. Showers likely for tomorrow. A chance of thunderstorms after 10 a.m., a high of 67. 90% chance of showers and thunderstorms for Monday night. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
It's This American Life from Ira Glass. Today's program, a small thing that gives me a tiny shred of hope. Okay, so it was Act One and the Tangled newsletter that inspired that name for today's episode. Now in the second half of the show, the thread from that story that we're going to pick up and keep pulling is what is happening with couples during this election, which is interesting because, as you've probably heard, there's a real gender gap between men and women this time out. Men prefer Trump by 8 percentage points. Women prefer Harris by 9. With that, we turn to Act Two of our show, Act Two, Till Death Do Us Partisan. Okay, so if you remember, Emily and Dick, who we heard in Act One, they talk openly between them about their political differences. One of our producers, Aviva de Kornfeld, spoke with a woman who is taking a different tactic with her husband.
It's been hard to find a time to talk with June. She's on a 3-week road trip with her husband, and they have almost no time apart. So we look for little cracks in her schedule to sneak in a call. Do you have a sense of how much time we have right now?
Probably about a half an hour. He's in the shower.
Okay. Wow, half an hour. Long shower. Luxurious.
Well, he has a whole routine, you know, yeah. Teeth and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
He's like a teenage girl in that way.
Okay. Do you mind if I record this call?
I don't mind, but I'm a little bit, you know, concerned about, you know, I don't want to get in trouble.
The trouble June's trying to avoid is an argument with her husband. They're both conservatives, but after voting Republican for her entire life, this election, June will be secretly voting for Kamala Harris. Her husband doesn't know about her plans.
Men. So I really just, that's sort of why I'm a secret voter, is because I'll vote however I want to vote, but having the conversations about it is where things, you know, get just uncomfortable.
While we talk, June is pacing around the backyard of their rental house, where her husband can't hear her. It's not like she's scared of him. She just doesn't want to fight with him, which is why we're using a pseudonym. June's not her real name. The Harris campaign is counting on the idea that there are lots of Junes out there. They're marketing to these women, specifically, sending Republicans like Liz Cheney all over the country to talk to them. And there's a whole grassroots effort of people sticking post-it notes in public restrooms, reminding these women their vote is private. I wondered what it was like for people in this situation. Is it really possible to keep a secret like this from the person you share a house and a life with? How do you do that? What are the consequences? On our call, June made a point to say it wasn't always this way. She's been with her husband, who I'll call Rick, for 20 years now. They first met in an online group for single parents. June had 3 little kids from a previous pretty rough marriage. Rick had 2 kids, and their courtship started over the phone.
Yes. I mean, like being in middle school, like you'd spend all day with your best friend in middle school and then immediately come home and get on the phone with her. We would just talk for hours and hours and hours. It just felt like the easiest, most natural connection.
By the time June and Rick actually met in real life a few months later, they were basically already a couple. A year later, they got married, and Rick raised June's kids as his own, calls them his kids. June says Rick was totally apolitical when they met, had never voted, wasn't even registered, which did not sit right with June. She's always been very politically engaged, makes a real effort to vote in every election, not just the big ones. Since June was a lifelong Republican, Rick also registered as a Republican. And in 2016, they both voted for Donald Trump together. But June immediately regretted it. She never liked Trump, but it felt wrong to her not to vote, and she assumed he wouldn't win anyway. After the election, June started to lean away from her political party, but Rick reached towards it. He started watching Fox News every day.
And it's just stirring something up inside of him that makes him afraid or just like angsty or whatever. And like, it just comes bubbling out. Like, he's not a big talker to anybody else. I'm the main person that he talks to. So I think if he talked to a lot of people, maybe I wouldn't be getting so much of it down the barrel, but because I'm his, you know, I'm his main person, I think I get it all, because I think it makes him very anxious.
Does he have friends?
No.
Not even one?
I mean, he has, so one of the pastors at my church really likes him, but no, he doesn't really like people very much.
Rick used to ask June about her opinion on politics. She would read articles, and he would ask her to summarize them for him. That was a dynamic. She researched and came to an opinion, and he trusted her opinions. But these days,
the longer that Donald Trump has been on the picture, the sort of more like him my husband becomes, you know, just I'm not allowed to have my own opinions, and you know, I better not vote this way or that way, or, you know, I'm going to go with you and vote. And, you know, just really getting very hostile about it. And I guess Donald Trump just made it easier or more acceptable or more popular to act like that. And it's the only area where he's like that. But if we have a big confrontation about it, then it's, you know, then it becomes everything, you know. It's just...
Oh, I hear a little dog in the background.
You know, just, yes, yes, we have puppies with us, too.
June is having this disagreement with her husband during a moment when election coverage is nonstop. Ads are everywhere. Both campaigns are relentlessly calling and texting and emailing, all while she's stuck in a car with her husband. And this is all he wants to talk about. But June's got a couple strategies for dealing when politics comes up. Sometimes she tries something called gray rocking, which is basically just being as boring as possible in conversation, so Rick has nothing to seize on or react to. Other times she tries for a classic maneuver, the dodge.
I dodge a lot. No, I'm pretty good at dodging because I'm very busy. Honey, I'm very busy making dinner. I'm very busy, you know, with the cleaning, or I have to do some work or whatever. So I'd say maybe once every 10 days to 2 weeks do I let my guard down.
And when her guard drops, a fight ensues. They have a big fight every 10 days to 2 weeks because he keeps bringing politics up. He wants to talk to her about all this stuff. And it unsettles him when they're not on the same page. He wants her to engage, and so her refusal itself becomes a kind of fuel.
It ends up being very pushy, you know, like, why aren't you talking to me? Why don't you answer me? Like, he'll say things, and I just take the bait, you know. He'll say, like, you're a liberal.
And what do you say?
I say, I've been a conservative longer than you've been a conservative. Like, what are you talking about? Uh-huh. Like, I am a conservative. Donald Trump stole my...
Do you regret getting him politically engaged, given how things have turned out?
Totally.
Really?
Totally, yes.
talked to a bunch of people like June, women who plan to vote for Kamala, but are going to all sorts of lengths to avoid telling their family and friends about it. They're all lifelong conservatives, but then, for a lot of them, January 6th crossed a red line they didn't even know they had until it happened. And now they can't bring themselves to vote for Trump again. I talked to one woman in Louisiana who told me her parents knew she wasn't going to vote for Trump. They assume she's going to write in another Republican, which she's happy to let them think. She said it's inconceivable to her parents that she could possibly vote for a Democrat. Another woman in Missouri told me that once Kamala entered the race, she tried to test the waters with her family, said she was thinking that maybe she would vote for Kamala. Her family's reaction was so strong, they said she was going to hell, that she was a communist, that she had to backtrack. And they haven't talked about it again since. I mentioned all this to June. I've talked to a bunch of people who are in different versions of your situation, and everyone tries to avoid talking about politics with their family because they obviously want to maintain close relationships with their family. And it's, they avoid talking about it in service of the relationship, but actually they just can't be as close with their family as they want to be if they can't really share this part of their life with them.
Right. I think like we sort of watch movies and TV shows where like one sort of explosive thing happens that ends up, you know, destroying a relationship or whatever it is. But I think in actuality, those kinds of deteriorations happen little by little over time. And it's these small, small things that chip away at, you know, any family relationship or any kind of relationship. And so I think I probably just make a short-term, easy decision to avoid it. And it probably does have longer-term consequences.
I want to be clear. June and Rick still have nice parts of their marriage. They still go on their daily walks. They have those two little dogs that they both obsess over. Rick does this whole routine with the dogs during their nightly snack time, which delights June. But with the wall-to-wall election noise, politics is increasingly crowding out those other, more peaceful parts of their lives.
I have an older sister who's married to a like-minded man, and their relationship is just so different. There's just so much more back and forth between the two of them, and there's so much less just angst about, like, she can be who she wants to be, and he's just more secure in that, you know, she can voice her opinion, and it just doesn't ever seem like she's looking over her shoulder. But I definitely feel like I need to look over my shoulder, obviously. And sitting in the backyard, I just feel like I have to look over my back shoulder, not because something necessarily bad will happen to me, but just like it's just too exhausting to keep explaining myself, I guess. I just don't really want to keep doing that.
Who does your husband think you're voting for?
I think he's afraid I'm going to vote for Kamala. You know, I think he has a clue that I'm a never Trumper, but I wouldn't say like he knows for 100% sure.
Tell me if this is like way off base.
Sure.
Because I don't mean to overstep, but it sounds kind of lonely.
Oh,
being
my gosh,
in a
it's terrible.
Marriage.
Oh my gosh, it's terrible. Don't make me cry. Yes, he's not who I thought he was, or he's becoming somebody that. Yes, it's like I'm not fully who I am with him, and it's sad.
Yeah. Do you have a plan for if it keeps going down this road, or is there, do you have any red lines, or you're just hoping, you know, once the election's over, then
yeah,
you can go back to talking about,
yeah,
other stuff?
It sort of like steams up and then cools off, steams up and then cools off. Yeah, I probably am not going to do anything. I mean, I'm on the phone. I'll be done in just 5 minutes. Okay. Yeah, it's not like a fun life to talk about Donald Trump. I just want to forget about him.
Was that your husband who came out?
Yeah.
Just now?
Yes.
Okay, it sounds like you should go.
I should probably wrap it up, yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll let you go. I really appreciate you talking.
Sure, thank you. It was good to talk with you. Thank you.
Okay.
All right, bye.
Bye. A few days after our call, I got a text from June. She was home from her trip and had gone to vote early with her daughter. She sent me a selfie of the two of them, beaming, with their matching voting stickers. They both voted for Kamala. June said she felt relieved to have cast her vote, because now no one could take it away from her. And more than that, she actually feels excited about the prospect of a Harris presidency. She thinks she'll do a good job. After they voted, June and her daughter celebrated, hugged goodbye, and then June peeled her sticker off and went home.
Aviva de Kornfeld is one of the producers of our show. Okay, so the biggest gap between men and women in this election is with younger voters, people under 30. An NBC News poll found that 59% of young women in that group support Harris, compared to 42% of men. Which got us wondering, how is a person that age supposed to find love? Those numbers, if you are straight and under 30 and looking for somebody of the same party, they are not great. And that question brings us to Act 3 of our show. Act 3, let me be frank. So when Aviva de Kornfeld was reaching out to couples looking for people to interview for the story that you just heard, one of the people she came across was a guy named Frank Filicomo. He's trying to navigate his way through the rocky shoals of this gender divide. So she talked to him, too, about what that's like.
Last year, Frank had a date that went exactly the way you hope a first date goes. The conversation felt easy. They made each other laugh. And at the end of the date, they said goodnight. No kiss. Frank doesn't kiss on first dates. And went home.
And then we were texted. She was texting me right after the date. Had such a great time. You know, when do we get to do this again? And, you know, we're exchanging ideas for what our next date's going to be. And then the morning of the second date, she messages me. And she said, you know, I did some thinking and I would not like to go out with you again. And
what do you think's happening when she says that?
Well, I didn't think. I knew what happened.
Oh, what happened?
What happened is that I have a very unique Italian last name. If you Google me, I come right up.
Mm-hmm.
I think I wrote, so you must have looked me up. And she said, yes. And she sent me a screenshot. And I went, ah, got it. You know.
The thing Frank's date had discovered about him, he's a Republican, voted for Trump twice. The screenshot was of an article he'd written for a conservative magazine. Trying to date in deep blue New York City as a registered Republican, perhaps unsurprisingly, not so easy. He knows better than to lead with his politics. He intentionally leaves it off his dating profile. But even so, sometimes Frank can't even get past the texting phase and onto the actual date.
A lot of women have said, okay, you know, you seem great and I'd like to meet you and go on a date. But first, you know, who did you vote for? Or what are your politics?
Oh, really?
And then that's when I...
What do you say?
I say that I'm an independent thinker. And
That's really coded as right wing.
Exactly. And
you might as well just say, I voted for Donald Trump.
Yeah, and I have.
And then what do they say?
They say, well, I can't do it. Can't do it.
By Frank's estimate, 40 to 50 women have canceled their dates with him upon discovering his politics. Having been born and raised in Brooklyn, Frank has this sort of odd problem on his hands, because he basically fits in, unless he's talking.
Everyone I've ever met has told me that they think I'm some Bernie progressive. I strike people as being left-wing.
Yeah. Well, you live in Brooklyn, and you have little glasses, so.
I have little glasses and holes in my ears.
He used to have gauges. He also has a bunch of tattoos. He's a real mix of things. He's got some punk in him, but he's also nerdy. Casually says words like verklempt and pugilistic. Though you can't see any of his edge today. He came straight from his job at a right-wing nonprofit. So he's in his full conservative drag. Suit, tie, token fun socks. Frank's been a conservative since he was little. He grew up in a right-leaning household and proudly wore a McCain Palin button on his backpack at school when he was 11. The main thing that makes Frank a conservative these days, he says, is that national sovereignty is extremely important to him, meaning He thinks we should close the border, build a wall if we need to, anything to discourage undocumented immigrants from coming here. Otherwise, basically, he's one of those fiscally conservative, socially liberal guys. But his dates mostly care about that conservative part. He remembers this one first date that really kind of stung, because he was particularly excited about her. They were at a bar, bantering back and forth.
And then she said, so what do you do for work? And there's kind of no way around that. You know, I could say, I could be super ambiguous and say, oh, I work for a nonprofit.
Yeah.
But then that lends itself to, okay, well, which nonprofit?
Yeah, that could mean anything.
Right.
Frank told her he worked for a branch of the famously conservative outlet, The National Review, where he occasionally writes. His date thought he meant The Nation, which is kind of the opposite.
And I clarified, no, a little different.
How'd you describe the difference?
I said, we're more on the right, which is my euphemistic way of saying we're conservative, because we are. And I said that, and immediately her whole demeanor changed.
They were only 20 minutes into the date and decided to call it a night.
I actually planned on walking her out or walking her to the train station. And so I said, okay, let me get the bill. And I go up to the bar to get the bill, and then I came back and she was gone.
Frank thought maybe she'd gone to the bathroom, but his date had scooted to the bar and arrived with a helmet. Frank noticed the helmet was also gone.
I'm thinking, I don't think she took her helmet to the bathroom. But I said, let me give it a few minutes, you know. And I gave it a few minutes, and I said, she left. It does hurt. And when I say this to people, I don't mean to make it into a pity thing. You know, it's not like this is being conservative as some immutable characteristic, right? I don't want people to feel bad for me, but it does hurt. Because to me, it's like, who am I? After 27 years of existence, if my identity boils down to being a conservative and a registered Republican, then that's a sad 27 years that I've lived. That's really sad.
Frank's a registered Republican, but to him, that's the least interesting thing about him. Here are some things that Frank would like people to know about him. He plays jazz guitar. He has a very old cat, 17 years old, who is still in remarkably good health. He's also obsessed with aquariums. He has 4 of them in his studio apartment. The stuff that Frank thinks should matter is the way you comport yourself in the world. Are you polite to wait staff? Do you hold the door for people? Do you check in on your friends when they're sick? Most of a relationship, he says, is not about politics. And so he wants the women he dates to see those other parts of him, not be blinded by his party affiliation. I asked Frank, why not just date conservative women? He insisted the conservative dating pool in New York City is simply too small. There's a filter on the dating app Hinge that you can pay for that does let you filter for political preference. He did try that once.
And I realized that it was meaningless, you know. I'm attracted to people for other reasons. In fact, I would put politics probably at the end.
What?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Why is that crazy?
Because the thing that should be at the end is, like, my favorite color is green.
That's more important.
No, it's not.
It absolutely is more important.
Why?
I'm tempted to push it back on you and say, why is politics important? It's not important. I don't think so at all, actually.
Yeah, but do you think that politics is less important to you because some of the policies that you might be voting for directly impact you in a less personal way than they impact the women that you want to date?
Oh, maybe. I think that's part of it. And I have a lot of empathy for people who are impacted more directly. But I think that, you know, I look at my day-to-day life and, you know, I'll walk through a door and someone, or I'll hold the door for someone and they'll walk through and they won't say thank you. And I go, what was that? What was that about? You know, it's stuff like that, little interpersonal interactions that mean something to me, you know,
But to you, but not to the people that you're dating. I'm sure the women you're dating would be it's much more important to them to be able to get an abortion than have a door held for them.
Oh, sure. But I'm one out of 340 million people. I'm not effectuating policy or something.
I can see why his dates don't see it that way. have some news to end this story with, which is that after dozens of dates, Frank is actually seeing someone. It's new, but it seems to be going well. She's a lefty, and she knows all about his views. Politics actually came up on their first date. It's been a few months now, and they've had a lot of conversations about politics. Frank told me his girlfriend's voting for Kamala Harris, and the idea that Frank might vote for Trump, that really, really bothers her. Recently, with the election coming up, they had one particularly hard conversation about it.
She said, you know, we care for each other, and we obviously enjoy being around each other, and we have for the past 4 or 5 months, however long it's been. And, you know, I don't think she said that she doesn't think it's a deal breaker for her, but it's something that concerns her, mm-hmm. you know, and I don't take that lightly. So it's made me do a lot of thinking.
What'd you say?
I said that I want you to know that I hear you. It was emotional. I think we were both a little verklempt.
His girlfriend kept saying, Trump's a rapist. You've got to vote for the whole person, not just the policies you like. These conversations with his girlfriend and other people have actually moved him. And so Frank is thinking of voting third party this election, which may have more meaning in his relationship than it does for our country, thanks to the Electoral College. Like most of us, Frank doesn't live in a swing state.
Viva de Kornfeld. We first heard about Frank in a story in The Guardian.
Oh yeah, if you don't speak, you'll never be heard. So get on your feet and jump on that beat. Kornfeld!
Well, our program was produced today by Bim Adewunmi. This American Life is delivered to public radio stations by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Support for This American Life comes from Progressive Insurance, home of Snapshot, offering a personalized rate on car insurance based on safe driving habits. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Snapshot is not available in California or from all agents. And from Odoo. Odoo streamlines every aspect of your company in one simple and efficient business management platform. More information at odoo.com. That's odoo.com. Thanks, as always, to our program's co-founder, Mr. Tori Malatia, always comparing himself to Mr. Potato Head.
I have little glasses and holes in my ears.
I'm Eric Glass. Back next week with more stories of This American Life.
You gotta vote!
Support for This American Life on KPR comes from Blue Collar Press. Located in Lawrence, Kansas, Blue Collar Press helps businesses and creatives build their brands through merchandising, from design to production to fulfillment. More information at bluecollarpress.com. And the University of Kansas Libraries, a state, regional, and federal depository providing the resources and partnerships necessary for both research and academic success. More information available on social media at KU Libraries. From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence. KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia. KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City. KANQ Chanute. And always online for you at kansaspublicradio.org.
This is KPR Presents. I'm Kay McIntyre. If you ask most Kansans to name an abolitionist of the most dangerous kind, John Brown is probably the name that comes to mind. Today on KPR Presents, the most dangerous Kansas abolitionist you probably haven't heard of. Todd Melfeld and David Schaefer are the authors of Abolitionist of the Most Dangerous Kind, James Montgomery and His War on Slavery. Todd, David, thanks so much for coming in today.